You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of July, 2012, on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up on today's show, Syrians celebrate in the streets of Damascus as Syria's defense minister and others close to the Assad regime are killed by a suicide bomber.
The Syrian opposition has claimed the attack. We actually went and couldn't get close to the scene. It was sealed off immediately.
Also ahead, two retired colonels are arrested for the murder of Chile's General Alberto Bachelet, who died in prison in 1974. And an Austrian court bans cowbells. They were keeping the neighbors awake at night. We talked to one man who keeps them close to his heart.
I have a cowbell in my bureau. You want to listen?
Yes, please. Stay with us for an hour of stories and a little music, too, coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. Now let's get the latest news from Christian Yeo.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Christian Yeo. Syrian forces have hit rebel positions across Damascus shortly after the government vowed to punish those responsible for a bomb attack which killed the defense minister and the president's brother-in-law. The state news agency said that armed forces had killed a large number of what they called terrorists in the central neighborhood of Midam. An Italian and two Spanish hostages have been freed in northern Mali by an Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group. The three aid workers were seized in a refugee camp near Tindouf in Algeria last October. The Spanish government says a plane will fly them to the region in the coming hours to bring them back home. British Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain will decide at the end of the year how many of its troops will leave Afghanistan in 2013. He made the comments after arriving in the country on a surprise visit. Britain has some 9,500 troops in Afghanistan and is due to withdraw 500 soldiers by the end of this year. The UK military is also facing swinging budget cuts, which will see troop numbers slashed and a greater reliance placed on technology. Mr. Cameron says the armed forces have his full admiration, but insists that reforms are essential.
I am absolutely full of support for our armed services and what they do. And yes, we do ask them to do a lot on our behalf. But I think it's in everybody's interest that we have a defence budget that really adds up. And we do now. And that's why we're able to invest in bits of kit like that Foxhound behind me. We've now got the best protected vehicles for our armed services that we've ever had in our history. Better than many other armies can boast.
A bomb planted by the Taliban has destroyed 22 NATO trucks carrying supplies to their forces in northern Afghanistan. 18 fuel tanks and four supply vehicles were parked in Aybak, the capital of Sangang province, when the bomb ripped through them, wounding one. Turkish officials say over 600 refugees crossed the border from Syria last night, and over 43,000 Syrian refugees are now living in camps along the border. Two generals were amongst those who fled last night. 20 Syrian generals are now sheltering in Turkey. The Syrian National Council has been meeting UN Security Council ambassadors, urging them to do more to enforce Kofi Annan's peace plan. The council is calling for more international pressure on the regime. Its executive director, Dr. Basma Kodami, says the peace plan is simply not working.
The situation under the Annan plan today is one that has not quelled any of the violence, and the regime's killing has in fact led to an escalation, that the message of another veto on a resolution at the UN Security Council will send the wrong message back both to the regime and to the Syrian people.
A ferry with around 280 people on board has sunk off the East African coast of the Zanzibar. It's unclear whether anyone's been killed. The ferry set sail from mainland Tanzania at around midday. Police say it's still unclear what caused the accident. Rescue operations are ongoing. Hungarian authorities say they've arrested a suspected Nazi war criminal and charged him with committing war crimes. Last week, reporters from a British newspaper found Laszlo Csatari living in Budapest. The 97-year-old's accused of assisting in the murders of nearly 16,000 Jews. In 1948, he was sentenced to death in absentia by a court in what was then Czechoslovakia. And taxi drivers in London say they'll be holding two more protests against being banned from using Special Olympic lanes on the city's roads. One of the protests is scheduled for the opening day of the Games. The lanes are reserved for Olympic vehicles, and anyone else faces a fine of £130 sterling for entering them. On Tuesday, traffic in central London was brought to a halt when hundreds of taxi drivers lined up outside Parliament. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And I thank you, Christian, on this very drizzly, grey London July afternoon.
Thank you.
Maybe you could bring us news of good weather.
I'll try and bring some sunshine next time.
Thanks very much. And the time is just coming up to 6 minutes past the hour here in London. And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyos. Seen on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντωστε καζίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
London μπορ, έζε Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδά, μπορεσε Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que quinina teiro noa, Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talvekja.
Events are moving quickly and they continue on their violent course in Syria. Three men close to President Assad, including his defense minister, were killed today in an attack by a suicide bomber. In a moment, we'll be assessing the significance of today's dramatic events. But first, we'll hear from Monocle contributor Daisy Moore, who is in Damascus. I talked with her a few minutes ago and began by asking her about what she'd witnessed today.
For us, it started early this morning when we went to the military hospital on the outskirts of the city and we attended funerals of more than 30 soldiers that died yesterday. Family members clearly very, very upset. You know, awful scenes of people screaming and crying, the dead bodies being brought into cars to take them to their resting place. People there were very defiant and, you know, supporting the regime, saying they will continue fighting these terrorists, blaming the West, blaming the media, blaming all kinds of people. And it was quite a scene.
Tell us about this suicide bomb attack at the very center of the Assad regime. This suicide bomber hit the National Security Building. Take us through those events today, please.
It was a loud blast, fairly center in the city, and it killed the defense minister, Asaf Shaukat, and some really high-profile people from the Syrian regime. Obviously, this sent a shock throughout the country, throughout the city. I can only speak for where I am now, but people are clearly very shocked, afraid of what happened, that this could happen in the city center. We had an immediate response from the Ministry of Information. The minister said this were foreign elements that killed these two high-profile people from the regime. The Syrian opposition has claimed the attack. We actually went and couldn't get close to the scene. It was sealed off immediately.
Is there a sense there that this attack at the heart of the regime today is a sign that the end game could be near for Assad?
It really depends on who you speak to. Here in the city centre, there are still people that really support the regime and are very defiant and convinced that this regime will beat the foreign elements and the terrorists. And of course, there are many others from the opposition not supporting the regime that do see this as the end game, so close to the city centre, such high-profile people. So, yes, here in Damascus, there are still people that think, you know, their president will survive and it will just be fine in a little while.
Well, that was Daisy Moore, our contributor on the ground in Damascus in Syria. And listening to her was Professor Scott Lucas from the University of Birmingham and the author of the Middle East blog EA Worldview. And good evening, Professor Lucas.
Good
evening to you.
Dramatic events for sure in Syria today, yet we're hearing from Daisy there on the ground that many people are out in the streets living life normally. Now, how significant do you think today's attack and events are?
Well, Damascus is a very large city, just like London would be. So you could be in one part of the city and be at some distance from these events that we've talked about, which are not only the bombing of the National Security building, killing three top Assad regime members, but also street fights, fights which have been going on for 4 days now in some of the suburbs, but in some of the sections of the city, especially in the southern part of this. So yes, this is very serious. This is the most serious threat that the Assad regime has faced in the 16 months of the uprising. And beyond the headlines, what hasn't really been reported today, because so much has been occurring, is that the insurgents have advanced in other areas of the country, and there are reports that some of the insurgents are moving towards Damascus. So rather than this threat receding over coming days, there could be even more intense battles in the next week to come.
Wow. Just starting with the the breach of security at the very heart of the security machine in that country, how does a suicide bomber get there?
Well, I'm going to complicate things a bit more and add to the mystery, and that is that the initial reports were a suicide bomber, but in fact, the later reports, as claimed by the opposition, is that they had managed to get a bomb inside the meeting room. Now, this was a meeting of effectively what was the war cabinet, the national security cabinet of the Assad regime, even though the president, we don't think, was there. Now, if they got a remote-controlled device inside that room, that means that someone from inside the regime had to help them, because this would be a very fortified area. That means that this is not just a question of this attack taking place today, but does it mean that members of the regime are thinking there are people turning against us from within and we could have more attacks like this?
And possibly more defectors. I mean, just to jump to the generals, I think there's some 20 of them over the border somewhere now.
That's absolutely right. That's a very important story to follow. There have been 20 generals who have left the military forces, including three in the last 72 hours. Now, when those generals leave, they don't only just simply sap the strength of the military, they take information with them. So it could be, for example, that some of the defectors have been providing the opposition information that has contributed or led to these attacks, including the one that took place today.
Earlier you mentioned Assad. We didn't think he was in or near the blast today, but we don't really know where he is or how he is, or do we?
We don't know where he is. Equally important, we do not know where his brother is. Now, his brother is the commander of the most elite unit amongst the Syrian military, the 4th Brigade. And there was a report today, an unconfirmed report today, that there was a bomb which went off near their headquarters. So neither the president nor his brother, these two key figures, have been seen. And interesting that for all the drama that we've talked about today, unlike previous occasions when state television has actually shown images of what occurred, they have not done so today. So although we know that at least three key members of the regime are dead, we don't know how serious this is. It could, in fact, go beyond the headlines that we're reporting.
And of course, you mentioned the brother there. It is all very close to the family because one of the three men killed today is a brother-in-law of Assad.
Yes, this is Asaf Shakat. Now, he is not only the brother-in-law of Assad, he is technically the deputy minister of defense, but that's sort of a misleading title. It doesn't give tribute to his importance, because he really headed up a number of Syria's intelligence services. So he was both the man who was controlling operations against the insurgents in terms of deciding where forces should be deployed, how serious the insurgent threat was, and of course he had all this information at his disposal. He was very well known to Western intelligence services. In a sense, if we were going to talk seriously about a negotiated settlement with President Assad stepping down, he would have been part of the talks. That is no longer the case.
Could I ask you, God, there's so many questions here, but how much would we be able to know about what's going on in Assad's head tonight?
I think President Assad himself, we gave a couple of interviews 2 weeks ago where he gave us sort of an insight into what was going on, in that he spoke to a Turkish newspaper, then he spoke to a French television station to put up this very defiant act, which was, we're in control here, but we are facing terrorists who are being, to some degree, supported by the West, including the U.S. Now, if you take that at face value, Assad genuinely believed, first of all, that this opposition included not only terrorists, but included some members of the international community. And he's not going to negotiate if he honestly thinks he's being sold out. At the same time, he didn't see this as a threat which really was challenging the heart of his regime. So the question you've asked, which I can't answer, is does what occurred today shake Assad's faith? Because we've known for weeks not only that the insurgents are a threat, but that they control part of Syria, and we knew they were moving in on the capital. It seemed to me that Assad did not really recognize how serious this was, and I'll be waiting for a statement to indicate, does he actually indicate that he knows that he's in danger, even if he's not basically deciding he'll step down and leave the country.
Okay, next question. How much support do you think remains for him?
I think it's a mixed picture in terms of support, because I think there are sections of the Syrian community, including the Alawites, which is the community to which Assad and members of his circle belong, including some support from members of the Christian community, including some support, although it's decreasing, from members of the business community, that we prefer backing this regime. And I think your correspondent indicated that that's still true in Damascus. However, beyond that question, even if people support Assad, I think the takeaway from today is that confidence in the regime has been shattered. If you get enough people, whether or not they actually support the regime, believe that this regime, in fact, cannot sustain itself, then that becomes, and I hate to use this cliche, but it becomes a tipping point. And it's that loss of confidence that I think people should be looking at over the next few days, along with signs that the insurgents are stepping up their operations.
Okay, thank you very much for that vivid analysis. Appreciate it. Professor Scott Lucas from the University of Birmingham and author of the Middle East blog EA Worldview. This is, the time is now 18 minutes past the hour, and you are listening to Midori House. Please stay with us. In a moment, we're going to head to Chile, where two retired colonels have been charged with murder in the death of General Bachelet in 1974.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's that time of year again when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to even get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too. From five cities that are never going to win on metrics, but which we love anyway, to 10 surprising leaders you should know, to 50 things to improve your life. And our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports.
In the culture section, we showcase some of our favourite local heroes, from the record shop owner in Bangkok to the newsstand kiosk owner in Milan and the guy with a book truck in Tokyo. We'll also have a cultural calendar with all the best books, music, films and art for the summer ahead.
In the design section, we head to Marina City, a pair of modernist towers that is home to one of Chicago's more interesting communities. And we pack our swimming trunks and costumes and make for Lugano, where we profile this season's swimwear.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle. It's on newsstands now.
Two retired Chilean colonels have been charged with the murder of General Alberto Bachelet in 1974 while he was in prison for opposing the military coup which overthrew President Allende. He was the father of the former Chilean president, Michelle Bachelet. On the line from Santiago now, we have Monocle correspondent Steve Bodson. Hello.
Hello, how are you this evening?
I'm all right. How are you? I want to hear from you how this news was received in Chile today.
Right. Well, honestly, it hasn't been the big news that you might expect. These two colonels have been in the eye of justice for a long time, and I think that at this point there's a bit of a jaded sensibility toward them. It will be interesting if this case actually moves forward and new facts come out and they're actually held responsible. But the fact is, these same two people have been on trial before. And in the last trial, it was another torture that actually did lead to death, but they weren't tried for torture leading to death in that case. They were tried for torture. And they ended up with three-year probation sentences. That is to say that they had to keep checking into the court for 3 years, but they weren't even held in prison. So it's I think that the hopes are pretty dim as far as actually seeing these people face justice.
Why is the prosecution having such a hard time making charges stick?
The criminal justice system in Chile is very... it gives a lot of benefits to defendants, for one thing. And there are also issues of evidence. At this point, the issue with these people is that, well, for example, the people who died in custody, it's really hard to prove who exactly caused the death, exactly whether their death was really caused by torture. In the case of General Bachelet, he actually died of heart disease. And there was just a new medical report that came out last week saying that heart disease was exacerbated by the torture, and that's really why he died. That in particular, he was there were some tortures such as stress positions, being forced to go long periods of time without water or without urinating, and that those exacerbated the heart disease and caused his death. That medical report has allowed this new trial to go ahead. But that type of report is painstaking. It's also subject to, obviously the defense is going to say that report coming out in 2012 after a death in 1974 is not reliable. It's hard to prove these things 38 years later. So it's I think that the defense will actually have a chance in defending themselves against this charge of torture leading to death.
Steve, has the former president, Michelle Bachelet, spoken about these arrests or charges, rather?
I haven't heard her speaking about it. Yesterday, her mother actually came forward with a lawyer and basically said that if the state hadn't pursued prosecutions, she would have pursued what's essentially an individual type of prosecution. It's possible to sue people in civil court for criminal acts in Chile. So she said she was planning on that if the state hadn't taken the lead. So I think that the family, they have stated again and again that they want the torturers to face justice. Of course, this is also just one part of the situation because of the people who have been implicated in the torture at that at the old military academy. There were 26 different people who have been named repeatedly by victims, by their survivors, by colleagues as having been involved in the torture there. And these two have been, like I said, in the eye of justice before. They're now being tried again. But there are quite a few people who have really managed to walk away from the situation and so far have not been at least incarcerated. Some of them have faced lawsuits and so forth.
Okay, Steve Bodson, thanks very much for that wrap-up. Now, we are also joined by the journalist Mary Helen Spooner, who has written about Chile before and after Pinochet, and she is also on the telephone line now. Good evening.
Good evening to you.
Now, this is an arrest, as we just heard from Steve, in a string of many. How important is this one?
It's a high-profile case, and it adds more clarity to what happened. But as Steve said, a lot of Chilean public opinion is getting a bit jaded. This does add some new details, of course. As he said, there was a medical report issued about a month ago which said that General Bachelet had a heart condition, and his condition was made worse by the treatment he received.
So more detail coming out, and when so much time has passed, the prosecution needs all the details it can get its hands on to bring the case forward. What do you think the outlook is for the prosecution on this one?
Well, there are more witnesses. A lawyer for the family said there were more witnesses and they expected more indictments in the case. That one of the witnesses is a former Air Force officer who was arrested and held at the War Academy along with General Bachelet, who identified these two colonels who were indicted.
Is he the man you've talked with? I understand you talked with a witness to Bachelet's death.
No, this was a former Army Reserve officer who was being held at the public jail at the time of the death.
Could you tell us about the person who did witness his death, please?
This was Corporal Nelson Morales Leal. He was an Army reservist called up for active duty right before the coup, who was so horrified by the abuses that he witnessed that he deliberately got himself arrested for disorderly conduct in order to avoid further military service. He ended up in the public jail as an ordinary prisoner, not a political prisoner. And he was a witness. He was around when General Bachelet died, collapsed of the heart attack. A sympathetic prison guard notified a Chilean radio station, a relatively independent one, which still managed to operate in the months after the coup. And so the news of General Bachelet's death came out rather early. And in wake of that incident, of course, the military closed down that radio station.
Can you tell us something about how prisoners were generally treated back then, the political prisoners?
It varied, but very brutally, generally.
Can you tell us, you give us some detail?
Well, there was torture, the kinds that you've seen on Amnesty International, beatings, sleep deprivation, electric shock, everything you've heard before.
Those tired lists that keep reappearing.
Yes.
How important is it for Chile, for the country, for the people there, to resolve this case and to, deal with the people who killed General Bachelet?
It is important, although General Bachelet is one of thousands who was killed after the coup. In 1991, the new civilian government came out with a truth commission who issued a report listing or documenting over 3,000 deaths. And then there was a subsequent report a few years later looking into torture cases. And there are still more cases added to them that, you know, new witnesses come forth and so forth, so the list grows longer. So there's quite a backlog in the Chilean judicial system.
And just before we say goodbye, I did want to ask you about other members of his family, General Bachelet. His wife also, was she also tortured?
She and her daughter were arrested, I think, in 1974. I don't have the exact date, and brought to the notorious Villa Grimaldi Detention Center, where they were mistreated pretty badly, although former President Bachelet says she did not get the worst of it. Other prisoners had a much harder time of it than she did. After that, they went into exile. And in 1979, the story is that General Bachelet's widow contacted a senior member of the Chilean Air Force asking if it would be all right if they returned, and they were given the all clear to come back to Chile.
Mary Helen Spooner, thank you very much for joining us tonight. You're a journalist and author. Your most recent book, The General's Slow Retreat, Chile After Pinochet, describes the country's transition to democracy. Time now for some music, and this is a preview of a new track by Manchester-based soul singer Josephine. It's out next month. Here is What a Day. And that was What a Day by Josephine. And the time now is 31 minutes past the hour.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljati, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And please stay with us here on Monocle 24. Midori House is the show, and in the next half hour, we're going to be hearing from contemporary painter and sculptor Luke Caulfield, whose exhibition has just opened in London. And we'll find out why this sound is causing such a kerfuffle in the Alps, the bells, not the mooing. First, here's Christian with the news headlines.
Thanks, Nancy. World leaders are currently discussing the Syria crisis as violence continues to rock Damascus in the wake of the bomb attack which killed the country's defense minister and President Assad's brother-in-law. In the last few minutes, White House spokesman Jay Carney said the window is closing to find a peaceful solution and added the U.S. did not know the whereabouts of President Assad. U.S. President Obama has discussed the issue via phone, with the Kremlin reporting that sides still differ on the practical resolution to the conflict. The U.N. Security Council has postponed a vote on a Western-backed resolution that threatens Syrian authorities with sanctions. Meanwhile, Turkish officials say more than 600 refugees crossed the border from Syria last night, and over 43,000 Syrian refugees are now living in camps along the border. Two generals were amongst those who fled last night, and 20 Syrian generals are now sheltering in Turkey. An Italian and two Spanish hostages have been freed in northern Mali by an Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group. The three aid workers were seized in a refugee camp near Tindouf in Algeria last October. The Spanish government says a plane will fly to the region in the coming hours to bring them home. British Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain will decide by the end of the year how many of its troops will leave Afghanistan in 2013. He made the comments after arriving in the country on a surprise visit. Britain has some 9,500 troops in Afghanistan and is due to withdraw 500 soldiers by the end of this year. The UK military is also facing swinging budget cuts, which will see troop numbers slashed and a greater reliance placed on technology. Meanwhile, a bomb planted by the Taliban has destroyed 22 NATO trucks carrying supplies to their forces in northern Afghanistan. 18 fuel trucks and fuel supply vehicles were parked in Abak, the capital of Samarkand province, when a bomb ripped through them, wounding one. Elsewhere in Afghanistan, police in neighbouring Bangalan province say they've detained 10 suspected Taliban members with so-called magnetic bombs, which they were trying to attach to supply trucks. A ferry has sunk off the East African coast with around 280 people on board. The ferry set sail from mainland Tanzania at around midday, bound for Zanzibar. A rescue operation is now underway. And India is to review its aviation strategy to develop the country as a global travel hub. India's civil aviation ministry is considering increasing bilateral air service agreements and expanding routes to Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities. The ministry has also proposed setting up a national aviation university with the aim of creating an aviation training hub for the entire region. And those are the stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
An Austrian tradition, the ringing cowbell, is under threat. The clanging bell's toll got to be too much for the neighbors of a particularly noisy cow field in Stallhoven, so a judge has ordered the bells be silenced. Earlier today, I spoke with Josef Heckenberger, the president of the Tyrolean Chamber of Commerce. And Mr. Heckenberger, I can tell you, is none too happy about the decision. I gather you really like the sound of cowbells. Why is that?
This sound is part of our alpine traditions, and moreover, it helps the cattle to be safe on the pastures.
Something seems to have gone wrong now. What is the problem?
The problem was that some people felt annoyed by the sound of cowbells during nighttime.
But this is not unusual. Cowbells are part of your very long tradition.
Cowbells are a tradition, have a very long tradition, yes. It's actually not the reason which bells cows are wearing, but rather the sound which is produced by an entire flock.
It seems extraordinary that this case had to go to court.
There was obviously no other way to solving the problems. We don't understand the importance of any such judgment by court, since there are more important issues to solve than the handling of cowbells.
Could the cows wear bells that are not so loud?
It's actually not the reason which bells cows are wearing, but rather the sound which is produced by an entire flock.
So maybe it's okay with one or two cows, but when you get 20 or 30...
One or two or three is no problem, but when there more is, this is maybe a problem.
Do you like to sleep to the sound of cowbells?
Yes, I like it very much to sleep with the sound of cowbells.
Why?
Because it's calming.
I like to sleep like a baby, yes.
What do you think this ruling is going to do for the image of the Tyrol in Austria?
This judgment isn't valid for Tyrol, but for the province of Styria. So we are not concerned about our image.
Will it be damaging for Austria?
No, I think it's not the only important issue.
How big a problem do you think this could become?
We don't think there will be any further problems for the entire country. But if so, we would take up any possible means to prevent us from a banning of cowbells on our pastures.
Do you think you can stop this decision? And do you think this farmer can still have his cows wear bells?
I think we can stop this problem, yes. We will be fighting for keeping the bells on the cows.
If you do not win, you will need to keep a cowbell beside your bed.
I have a cowbell in my bureau. You want to listen?
Yes, please.
Have you heard?
Yes, I have heard, and I gather that makes you sleep well. Well, I hope you have a good sleep tonight.
Yes, I hope too. Thank you, and goodbye. I'm done.
Josef Heckenberger is president of the Tyrolean Chamber of Commerce, and he was talking with me from his office earlier, replete with cowbell. You're listening to Midori House, and the time now is 38 minutes past the hour. Stay with us, because coming up, Monocle's Jack Phillips meets artist Luke Caulfield. This month, the Lazaridis Gallery in London's West End plays home to a series of work by Luke Caulfield. The British Madrid-based artist has exhibited widely around the world. His large-scale paintings have won him prizes and accolades, including the NatWest Art Prize and the British School in Rome Fellowship. Secondhand is his latest body of work, and Monocle's Jack Phillips went to the gallery to take a private tour.
Contemporary artist Luke Caulfield believes the present has already passed, and his mixed-media paintings explore time and the inherent flaws in historical documentation. His latest show, Second Hand, has just opened at the Lazaridis Gallery in London's West End.
I feel that all paintings are a bit of a zombie piece of artwork, in a way, because there's that trace of the human touch.
Having obtained his stripes at the prestigious Slade Art School, the artist now resides in Milan. It's an eclectic show with some 20 paintings hanging in the main exhibition room, along with a series of small sculptures. They are audacious paintings, varied in scale, but all illuminated with light. A deft hand with the brush and a clear skill for a painterly narrative, Luke Caulfield discussed the more theoretical values with me as we took a walk around his show.
It's split into two main ideas. One is the documentation of electric light works from 20th century. It looks more like a 17th century Baroque painting, perhaps. And the other is a documentation of mafia bombs in Rome in 1993.
Each piece seems to take inspiration from both past and the present, drawing on styles and specific paintings from the archetypal canon to reference his documentary theme. But he juxtaposes this with references to more contemporary artists of the 1960s, and specifically contemporary light installations.
Documentation is the starting point, but it is really about the fallibility of documentation. So it's not the most successful documentation, but it's a structure that I've built up in which to press different points of temporal response. But after you break it down, you see that it's actually a documentation of the light coming from a Joseph Kossuth, in this case, neon artwork. However, the painting itself also has been manipulated through a lot of Photoshop clone tooling. And the reason I like the clone tool is that it copies something. I'm copying what's being copied. And then there's another element of human fallibility. And I think in the end, we kind of revere them and keep them very much alive in reproductions. And yet, you know, it's all about someone who's dead. The piece of paper itself, the object, doesn't have an indexical trace, doesn't have a trace of the past itself. It's just the original moment of the light hitting the camera.
The paintings vary in scale, from large 2-metre square canvases to smaller 30-centimetre square 6-part series. All seem to adopt an image-based narrative. Each title is descriptive of the image's intent, albeit ultimately failing in achieving it. Some show the images of cockerels or luminescent cockatoo parrots, whilst others are more abstract. The piece documentation, Martin Creed, The Lights Go On and Off, is virtually pitch black. Bruce Nauman's name pops up often, as we move to a piece that somewhat puts the story of Adam and Eve in the blender.
I think it's more obvious in this piece with Bruce Nauman, of a documentation of Bruce Nauman called No No, where I've taken various pieces of artwork, mainly from a painting by Van Haarlem of Adam and Eve. I've taken out Adam and Eve, just left the fig leaves there in a kind of very sloppy Photoshop way. And then I've got the blue and red lights behind a tree that has the apples on of Bruce Nauman's piece, which had a blue no and a red no. I want you to feel the dustiness of a studio and the dirtiness of a painting and the long time and possibly boredom or, you know, and I think that actually slows your eye down as well when you look at the piece. As I said, the sensation of time is what I'm interested in. How do we react to it? You know, we react to a photograph in a different way. We kind of scan it. If you see a painted photograph, you slow down your look and you can't help but feel that, okay, this is a object I'm interested in this at the moment, the drawn, slow sensation of time.
These truly are zombie paintings, and it would be easy to say that they are hybridised pieces using digital manipulation and borrowings from history to make a mutant commentary. But the works speak more of the futility of harnessing time, and that the documentation as a pursuit is an interesting, albeit a redundant one. Caulfield revels in this juxtaposition. His works, although garish, are playful, even darkly so. And as he wrestles with Greek sculpture, this is easily apparent.
Yeah, now we're in a more intimate space in the gallery, and all of this area relates to the 1993 mafia bombs in Rome and Florence, where they were targeting cultural targets. You know, I saw a list of all of the artworks that were damaged or some destroyed, and I knew that, you know, someone would be probably remaking these things. Rome's full of layers of time, and it was a way to deal with something quite modern, these 1993 bombs. And then another piece was damaged, was a discus thrower, which we've all seen, the discus thrower, and I think there are 7 or 8 Roman copies that exist, but they're all copies of the Greek bronze original, so they're in themselves copies. I like that idea that, you know, they've all got their own fallibilities. You know, the one that was re-put together in the British Museum, they put the head the wrong way, for example, you know. So it feels, you know, when you put the head the wrong way, it feels more of a zombie thing. It's like it's kind of moved its head in time, you know.
For Caulfield, it's not the reconciliation of ideas that appears important, but the recognition that visual and theoretical conflict exists. Greek mythology sits alongside images of Renaissance and Baroque. Dutch master techniques lay with Naumannesque neon splashes. They are complicated images, but intentionally so. Caulfield is continually questioning the idea of authorship and ownership, as well as the value of art itself. He leaves us with the question that if all artistic documentation of history fails, and all visual narrative proves an illusion, then what are we left with? At this show, Secondhand, the object becomes important, and their time and space of abject interest.
And that was our own Jack Phillips ending that report. The exhibition is on at the Lazaridis Gallery in central London until the 12th of August. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Thank you. What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films, focus on photography on monocle.com.
And now we have time for a track from a surprising new release by Elton John and Sydney dance music duo Panau. This is called Phoenix.
Why is it never loud on my lawn? Why does it rain and never say good day to the newborn? On the big screen they showed us the sun, but not as bright in life as the real one. It's never quite the same as the real one.
And that was, and still is, Phoenix from Elton John's new collaboration with Sydney DJ's Panau. And I'm sitting here listening to it with our culture man, Robert Bound.
Kapow.
Kapow or Panau?
Panau.
Panau, Kapow.
Sorry, I got it wrong.
You know, Panau, so, which is P-A-H hyphen now. Just in case people were wondering how
you
spell.
Australians can do many things apart from name a band, can't they?
And spell Panau. But it is kind of catchy when you say it.
It's very
And you were liking it. You were bopping into the studio.
It's a great song. I think that's one of those rare things which is sort of like a remix album done with the help of the person that was remixed in the first place, which is very cool. I think they're on Mercury Records, which is sort of, which Elton John has done a lot of work for and sort of collaborates with as well. And it sounds good. It sounds good coming out of the speakers of Monocle 24, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And it's so not Elton, but I know you're not here to talk about Elton.
Well, you mean it's a bit camp and gay and fast? So not Elton.
It's sort of sucky. Sweet.
It is.
Almost Cliff Richard.
I kind of wanted
know?
More vocals in there, actually, for my taste.
A few more?
That was, I think, Grey Seal. That was Grey Seal from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album.
Okay, well,
that's where that came from.
It could be remixed again.
We can do it.
You could do that.
If you play it backwards, it probably says something slightly satanic, but possibly not.
You are here because it's Wednesday, and
I'm
that's
Wednesday.
C, and C stands for culture, and you have Olympic art, and particularly, I understand, frieze art.
Yes,
I
boarded a bus at 9:30 this morning in Arnold Circus in East London, and this bus took us around some places of cultural interest around the Olympic site, the dreaded Olympic site.
I like it out there.
Maybe they'll drop in a sound effect
under
that. And some other places. And this is a thing done by Create, who are an East London-based sort of cultural institution that put on, basically try to support artists and try to get local people interested. Not necessarily, interestingly, in the art, but in putting on things that are near pubs that are owned by people or shops that are owned by people, so that if you need to go out and buy a packet of fags or you want to go and buy a bag of crisps after the opening, it sort of supports the local communities, but not in a snobbish kind of come and see this art and understand it way. So it's quite interesting.
Neat. So I want you to, you know, of course, take us on.
What are you doing? Taking your jacket off?
I'm taking my jacket off because it's warm.
I also, on the subjects of taking things off, Nancy, I noticed the lighting in here is less romantic than you normally favour.
I like it a little dimmer when you're here, and they're not paying any attention to me. But no, take me on the bus and tell me, is it worth it? Would it be worth it to go out there and toodle around and see these?
It would
stops.
Be worth it. It was very worth it for me today. I was very lucky because I'm a journalist and I went and they laid on a bus and there were a few others of us. This is not the thing that you'll get if you want to go and see it, maybe everybody else. But I'd recommend a couple of things. One thing is poplar baths, which were Edwardian. They were built in 1900. Is that Victorian or Edwardian? Anyway, they were built in 1900 and they're beautiful. Parts of them are sort of arts and crafts, parts of them are art deco. Beautiful thing that's obviously fallen into disrepair, like many things in that part of East London. And now that they've been taken over by some artists. And the artists that have done stuff in there are Anthea Hamilton and Nicholas Byrne, who do sculptures but in sort of inflatables. So they're these kind of strange, huge things. Betty Boo, the pop star from the 1980s. Do you remember Betty Boo?
Yes.
They've got a huge kind of 60-foot Betty Boo.
Sort of a bouncy castle
got a bouncy
type of thing?
And they do actually have a bouncy castle.
Do you go in it?
You go in it, and then you see a video, and it's that famous Love. It's the Robert Indiana Love sculpture, which is made into a bouncy castle. There's all these things. So it's basically to sort of get people in there.
Yeah.
People can stroke their chins, or kids can jump around. It might be the best of both worlds.
Okay. And that's just one. You said there were a
couple. That's one. Gary Webb is a sculptor and who usually does quite far out things, and he does things with amazing materials and makes strange shapes and tests the limits of physics and of men's ability to weld things to other things in his art and his sculpture. He's done a children's play park down in Charlton, which is the most amazing thing. And it's really a genuine thing of kids will see it and think there's an adventure playground. Adults will see it and wonder if there isn't a bit of mystical strangeness and contemporary art going on in it.
Groovy.
So it's a really lovely thing. There's a few really lovely things on this tour. Yeah.
And you have some lovely music. And I understand we could either go for it now or keep talking. Let's go for it.
We can
always dip out of it, talk over it.
That's a nice song. This is new from a Belgian lady called Mademoiselle 19. That's not like I don't know what 19 in French is. That's what she calls herself. And this song is from, exactly, this song is called Juillet Brillé, which I think means brilliant July or lovely July.
Juillet,
and it's in honour
Brillet.
Of this lovely weather we're having, Nancy.
Oh, it's great, great afternoon. Let's hear it. And that was Robert Bounds' choice for you.
That's a bit of chanson there. She's quite she's a little goer, Mademoiselle 19. She's sort of channeling the Bardot spirit in many ways.
She sounds lovely. I'd like to hear more.
So would I.
Okay. All right. This is the end of the show, and it's time for me to say thank you to my producer, Emma Nelson. Emma, you've been fabulous there behind the glass. Our researcher, Carolina Dubanek, and our studio managers, Jack Phillips and Alex Jacks. In 3 hours, that's 2200 London time, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be here with the Monocle Daily, where they'll be asking what Britain's banks can do to rescue their reputation. I'm sitting here wondering, should I have said Alex Jacks or Jakes? Jakes. Alex Jakes. So he gets like triple plug
Tracy
there.
Tracy Jacks and Alex
and
Jakes.
And they'll be, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will also be trying to find out how to organize a book festival in Somaliland. Up next is going to be the news, followed by this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. But from me, Nancy Durham, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.